Welcome to the Perp Web Podcast, hosted by Joe Bosch.
Hey, and good morning, everyone, and welcome to Perf Web 91. Of course, I'm your host, Joe Basha. Welcome. I can't believe we've done 91 Perf Web programs in total, probably over 100 programs. Welcome, everyone. And I see Medima Rose has been busy, but she's back on with us and viewing the program. Hey, how are you? Good to see you. And she's been just a little bit busy. I think all of us have been a little bit busy. Isn't that the truth? Okay, real quickly, let's go over our opening remarks. So you can reach out to us at contact@perfusioneducation.com. Happy to get emails from you guys. I try to answer, of course, all of them. I think I've done pretty well thus far. I think I have answered everything that I've gotten. So I appreciate that. If you want to be live on the program, if you want to, you can. You don't have to actually be here in the studio unless you want to be. We can do this, of course, virtually. We have a lot of technology that enables us to do that. And or if you have a subject that you'd like to discuss, a question, doesn't matter. You can find us if you want to call in and be live on the air at 832-239-5358. And that'll stay up the whole time. You see our scroll bar down below. It has where you can, all of our websites. It has our social media accounts. You can find us on anything you want, and that phone number will stay active the whole time. Our critical care and perfusion app, which has a section for perfusion and ECMO and hemodynamics, calculators, IV drug dose calculator, and conversions. You can use your phone and use the QR code right there. I'm actually going to be using the app today in our presentation. So I think that you'll get an idea of what it's able to do. Okay. And then, of course, our podcasts are available on whatever your favorite streaming software is. So you can go to us, you can listen to us in the car, you can listen to us, of course, at the beach. I can't think of anything better to do than to listen to us while you're at the beach. I think we'll go ahead and get started with the program. I'll go ahead and tell you, this hat is a mega hat. So it's a Make Education Great Again hat, a mega hat for those of you who are looking at it and wondering. And if you'd like to purchase any of our merchandise, you know, we have great cups. This one is a Perfusion Education cup and Perf Web cup, and it has my name on it. There's a lot of things like this. We also have cups, Perf Web cups, anything like that. Great Christmas gifts. If you'd like any of these things, you can certainly request them. And participating in the show, you know, when you call in, it's really meaningful to us, and we will usually send people things when they do that, when they participate in our programming. So you could get free gifts, free merch, okay? But if you want one of these hats, which I think it'd be hard to do, Make Perfusion Education Great Again. It would have been a little more complicated. Wouldn't be very a good acronym, but MEGA, I think, really does work for perfusionists. Okay, let's go ahead and get started. My subject today is wrap, and the way it was titled on the program was wrap, why I don't like it. And, you know, I'll just be fully transparent, I don't like it. But I want to be objective, and I want to look at it from that perspective and look at what the potential advantages or potential disadvantages are. So in medicine, as everyone is well aware, we live in a continual state of risk-benefit ratios. Is what we're doing have greater risk for the benefit or greater benefit for the risk? Everything we do has risk. There's no question about that. So let's explore, if we can, some of the purported benefits of actually utilizing wrap. So the primary benefit is decreased hemodilution. And that decreased hemodilution, which is the primary benefit, is going to result in decreased transfusions, decreased AKI rates, improved oxygenation, decreased vent time, which decreased length of stay, both in the ICU and the hospital, and decreased cost. So these are what benefits, primary benefits, that you would see from decreased hemodilution in general. So with RAP, really you're doing it for the purpose of decreasing hemodilution, which results in all of those things. The possible risks are hemodynamic instability for some period of time, which could result in hypoperfusion for some period of time. You could have an air entrainment issue, which would be rare but possible. And there can be a mishap. Mishaps can and do happen. Anytime you're doing some maneuver, and of course everyone understands RAP is retrograde autologous pump prime, right? RAPP. That's what the acronym stands for. There's various different ways of saying it, but I think that's the standard sort of vernacular. You're going to be, we'll discuss what that is, how we do it. Different people do it different ways to different degrees. There's a lot of variability in all of this. So let's just go ahead and kind of get into the slides here. The first article that I want to discuss comes from our friends in Brazil in 2011. And it's titled Retrograde Autologous Priming in Cardiopulmonary Bypass in adult patients, Effects on Blood Transfusion and Hemodilution. So this is the technique that they used, and I have to compliment, I think, these investigators, because this was done really well as far as what you're trying to accomplish. Whether I agree with it or not is a different story. But in regards to their technique, I thought it was pretty doggone good. So they're able to drain from the patient the venous line. They're able to drain retrograde from the arterial cannula. All of this is being shunted around and ending up in this collection bag. But they were able to actually fill their venous reservoir and flow the blood through the oxygenator itself and make its way also into collection bags. So as far as their system is concerned, they really wrapped, R-A-P-P, wrapped the circuit almost entirely. Now, it's impossible to do it entirely. In other words, you're going to have the patient's, only the patient's blood. There's going to be some dilutional effect, but very minimal the way they did it. I have to admit, this was a really good way to do it. The entire circuit. When we look at the demographic and surgical data, post-operative data on this particular study, a couple of things we have to take into consideration. One, the sample size, the patient, the N is very low. So this is not necessarily the most well-powered study, but you know, they did a good job, I think, at selecting the patients. You can see that they had a relatively split group, 27 to 25. There's some variation, and they explained that they just lost some data and weren't able to utilize them. But the age of the patients was very similar. The male to female ratio was similar. Their weights were similar. EFs were similar. Crits, hemoglobin, CPB time. Pretty much all of these things that they measured were very similar. Now, of course, at the very last line, save prime, they removed 729 cc's, and in the RAP group, and in the control group, it was, of course, zero. But other than that, a very well-matched group of people with the different metrics that they used. Pump times, clamp times, all very, very similar. The mean arterial pressure during cardiopulmonary bypass was also very similar. So in the wrap group on the middle column and then the control group to the right, they started off with a mean arterial pressure of in the 50s. It quickly went up to in the 70s, stayed in the 70s throughout the procedure up to 1 hour. So high 60s, low 70s, pretty much consistently. So you see pretty much, again, you know, the cases didn't have much of a difference in that regard. Now, what I found missing was the need for vasopressors, if any, was not really described for these pressures. So I don't really know from reading that article if there was an increased need for vasopressing, phenylephrine, norepi, whatever, vasopress, whatever your drug of choice would be, to maintain these pressures the way they are in either or both of those groups. I looked at the blood flow, and this is in milliliters per minute, during the bypass period, and in the wrap group, it started off about 3 liters, the control group to 4, and then to drop down to 2.9 and 3.5. So it looks to me, in looking at this, that all the way through the entirety of the procedure, the control group's flows were higher than the wrap group flows. The other thing that I was curious about, and I'm really uncertain on this, is why the flow was so much. I'm assuming it was a volume-related issue, but given the size of their patients, which, if you recall, was somewhere around 70 kilos, and I'm going to go back and just look at that slide if I can. Yeah, the weights were, see here, right about 74 and 75 kilograms. I found it very interesting that their flows had dropped down to this low. Now, that could be temperature related. They didn't need that much flow. Their bypass times really aren't, you know, weren't that long in the previous slide to explain this. But when I look at the next set of next table that they have, it is their SVR, their systemic arterial resistance, or systemic vascular resistance, whichever you prefer. And in the beginning, you can see here, they started out with what would be a normal SVR. 800 to 1200 is considered normal, right? But then we see that the SVR definitely in these, both the wrap group and the control group, is much higher. Now, there's not necessarily a big difference in the SVR between the wrap group and the control group, but the SVR to what is a normal SVR is quite a bit higher, leading me to believe there's a lot of vasopressor use in order to maintain the mean arterial pressure at the desired level of high 60s to low 70s. So I found that curious and didn't quite understand that. In this particular graph that you see here, in the top left, CPB mean arterial pressure, and you can kind of see here diagrammatically, you know, looking at it, that the control group tended to have a more consistent arterial pressure. You saw a little bit of a drop, a little bit lower in the the retrograde group, a little higher in the control group. My mistake there, sorry. Then moving over here, the red line is the retrograde or the wrap group, and the blue is the control, and this is the blood flow, and you can see that the control group clearly has higher blood flow, though in my opinion kind of low, than the wrap group. Actually, that's to me, for the size of the patient, pretty low. Again, I don't understand why, and there could be good reason for it, so I'm not indicting anything that they did here. I'm just not completely clear, but I do know that to me is too low of a flow. And to have the pressure you have to have a much higher SVR And here we see the SVR at the initiation, and then we see in both groups it goes quite high. In the control group, it is a little bit higher than in the retrograde prime group. Until the very end, it tends to become a little higher in the RAP group. And then over here, the lactate levels start off relatively low, and they don't go over 5, but both go up fairly high, with the control group going higher than the RAP group, even though the RAP group's blood flow was a little bit lower. And of course, that could be because it was less hemodiluted. You need more flow in order to accommodate for the decreased hemoglobin from the hemodilution. But nevertheless, I still think that both of these lactate levels, which eventually became the same post-CPB, are pretty high, which is, you know, and again, there could be a reason for it. It wasn't elucidated. Here we see the total crystalloid used during the CPB, and the red being the RAP group and the blue being the control. Clearly a lot more, about double the amount of volume. Intraoperatively, there was slightly more used in the control group than in the retrograde group, and this could be because as you further hemodilute, if you're not monitoring, measuring, or treating the COP, you could third space the volume and resulting in a greater loss of intravascular volume, resulting in the need for more volume, and that could be the reason for it here. You started off with a whole lot more volume, but then you ended up having to give a little bit more. Even in the postoperative period, the control group needed additional fluid, or somewhat more fluid, than in the RAP group. So I'm not sure the reason for that either, but my suspicions are that you have a greater reduction in colloid oncotic pressure because of the increased hemodilution, and that ultimately resulted in more third spacing and loss of volume from the intravascular space to the interstitial space, which results in then you having to give them more fluid. Here we see patients transfused for intraoperative area here. There was more blood given to the control group than to the RAP group. In the postoperative period, there was actually more blood and more plasma both given in the RAP group than in the control group. But the amounts are pretty, I'm not sure it really made a lot of difference, but it is interesting that intraoperatively, you gave more blood and plasma. Postoperatively, it was the opposite. You gave more blood and plasma to the RAP group versus the control. The total volume given for blood and plasma and blood of plasma, again, it mirrors what you see over here, but you have a larger amount of volume of plasma being given to the control group versus the number of patients. The patients that did get it clearly had to get more of it than they did the number of patients receiving it, or the average number that a person would get. Here we see hemoglobin levels, and there's clearly a drop in hemoglobin over the course of time, with it coming back up, probably because of diuresis, than in the priming retrograde group, or it's either this is diuresis, this is diuresis, and this is just where it was going to end up, or there's additional volume given to the patient, and that's why these both came together. This technically could have been much higher, but I don't know if they gave volume here that caused it to drop down below where it is and then not recover. But this patient had more volume and then was able to diurese, or these patients. Over here with the hematocrit, it basically mirrors what you see over here with the hemoglobin. So these are basically the same. In the discussion of these colleagues, they point out that despite the advantages attributed to the use of wrap, and I think that's a fair statement for them, I would couch it differently and say despite the purported advantages or the possible advantages or the, you know, potential advantages, but not necessarily just the advantages, few studies were carried out in the last decade, and this paper was written in 2011, so 2000 to 2011. Although recent isolated studies confirmed the benefits of using wrap, at least two of those studies in a meta-analysis were not favorable. And these results of theirs suggest that overall. So I went to the next sort of, I guess, extreme to this. And so to understand, they were very pro, our Brazilian colleagues, very pro use of wrap. In this study here, published in Anesthesia and Analgesia in 2004, it's the failure of retrograde autologous priming of the cardiopulmonary bypass circuit to reduce blood use after cardiac surgical procedures. And this is just a notification that these next slides coming up were downloaded from the Walters Kluwer site. Here we see in this article's table one, the no wrap group and the wrap group, and without belaboring all of this, the patient demographics, the operative procedure, the pre-existing conditions. Over here you see that there is no statistical difference between these groups. And so these groups seem to be very well matched based on our p-values over there. Also, the other thing I want to point out is, though it's still not a high-powered paper, it certainly is a higher-powered paper than the previous study. I also want to mention that the previous study was retrospective. This study is also retrospective, and in fact, all of the studies that I'm going to be discussing are retrospective analyses. So cases, pre-existing conditions, demographics, all and types of procedures, all very well matched. When we look at the intraoperative metrics, we see that the bypass time, cross clamp time, baseline hematocrit, crystalloid infused in the OR, and use of inotropy were all not statistically significantly different. The only thing that was different was the hematocrit on bypass. The no wrap group had the lowest hematocrit of 22%, whereas the wrap group was 26%, and that is statistically significant. And it's a significant difference, actually. That's four percentage points. This is just their slide on their multiple logistic regression coefficients. I'm not going to get into this. I'm not a statistician, but the data is there if you choose to look at it and understand some of that. When we look at now the utilization of blood and blood products in the no wrap group versus the wrap group, and again, probably easier just to say they looked at PAC cells, plasma, FFP, and platelets on bypass, in the OR, in the ICU, in the hospital step down unit, and overall. Over here again, no statistical difference is seen in any of these blood product administration numbers. So it doesn't seem from this study that there is an advantage that having a hematocrit of 22 versus 26 on bypass did not then translate into a difference in how many patients or the amount of units that were transfused to patients over the course of patients' hospital stay. This is the variables that they reviewed and the risk, relative risk, and with a 95% confidence level of whether or not you will receive transfusions. For all patients had a relative risk of 1.18, and this is overall RAP group, non-RAP group, first time CABG, males, females, CPB duration, all of that stuff. Pretty much, you know, detailed there. The commentary from these investigators is that hemodynamic instability can develop, again, can, when blood is drained from the patient into the arterial and venous lines, and may be worsened if pre-CPB autologous blood donation has been performed. So that, of course, that makes sense because you already have a patient who is somewhat intravascularly fluid depleted because you are replacing it, of course, with crystalloid, but crystalloid doesn't stay in the vascular space as long as blood does, clearly. Reduced arterial blood pressure, which means a systolic pressure less than 100, was treated in a standardized manner using crystalloid and phenylephrine boluses, 80 to 400 micrograms per aliquot. If these measures were unsuccessful, the RAP process was terminated. The incidence of hypotension during RAP, and it should be RAP as R-A-P-P, just so you know, was not determined in this investigation. So the incidence, they did not keep track of that. However, hypotension not responsive to these measures occurred in less than 1% of the patients, so it's rare, okay? Although induced hypovolemia may potentially adversely affect organ perfusion, the time from the start of the RAP until onset of CPB was typically brief, less than 5 to 8 minutes. So again, there are purported benefits and there are potential risks, but I definitely do believe that it is common to see a drop in blood pressure when you RAP, which is easily treated and very transient. And do not believe in any way that that transient period would have any detrimental effect on the patient's long-term outcome. It's extremely brief. So I think that's all a kind of a red herring as far as I'm concerned. In conclusion, these authors observed only a minimal reduction in PRBC use when RAP was routinely applied as a blood conservation modality. Patients with a larger initial red cell mass appear to derive a greater benefit from the RAP technique. And then further studies are needed to define the role of RAP in patients undergoing CPB. Now, the comment that the initial red cell mass appears to derive a greater benefit from this technique certainly does, you know, also make sense intuitively, I think, to all of us. Now, the reason I actually did this whole topic was this article, which is coming from 2021, and it is Foreman and colleagues. I thought it was an excellent paper, and I read it, and I actually reached out to Emily to see if they were going to be willing to present this data for us on the program, but I didn't hear back from her. So Emily, if you end up watching this one day, I would still love to invite you to actually review your own paper on our program. I think it's very well done. I'm very complimentary of it. I'm gonna go ahead and read the abstract because I think it's worth listening to in case you're listening and can't read it yourself. Retrograde autologous priming, otherwise known as RAP, is a process used to reduce hemodilution associated with the initiation of cardiopulmonary bypass. Previous studies have reported potential benefits to RAP. However, many of these studies do not evaluate the benefits of RAP with limited preoperative fluid administration combined with a condensed CPB circuit. So what Emily is saying and her colleagues are saying here is that you're looking at a big circuit, let's say a priming volume of 1,400 cc's or 1,200 cc's or 1,000 cc's. But if you reduced it even more, you were using not a mini system like the old MEC system, but you're using a condensed circuit where you're really using discipline to have your lines exactly the right length, not a lot of redundant tubing everywhere. Because I've said this a million times, every cc in a tubing line, arterial line, venous line, recirc line, it doesn't matter what line it is a cc not in your reservoir to give you the reservoir volume, the minimum operating level we need in order to maintain safe perfusion. Okay. We examined clinical metrics patients who underwent RAP versus those who did not prior to the initiation of CPB. This was a retrospective review, and this was 1,303 patients, so an even bigger study than the previous two. And of course, they were having open heart surgery, and they followed them for over a period. So this was a review over 2 years. RAP was used on all patients between June of 2017 and June of 2018, so 1 year, and not used on patients between July and June 30th where RAP was not employed. Both groups were subjected to a low prime circuit volume of between 800 and 900. We compared, and I think 800 to 900, you know, maybe 1,000. I think 1,000 is pretty common now. So 800 to 900, I think, is great, but 1,000 is very common. If you're 700, it's even better. I think that's a very important point they bring up. It's something that I really believe in. We compared these metrics for packed red blood cells, transfusion, oxygen delivery, so DO2, DO2i, postoperative AKI, albumin utilization, ventilator time, ICU length of stay, and 30-day mortality between the two groups. Our data analysis showed there were no statistically significant differences between the two groups on the incidence of postoperative AKI, PRBC administration, vent time, ICU, 30-day mortality, and length of stay. In the RAP group, there was a statistically significant lower oxygen delivery and a statistically significant increased volume of albumin administered postoperatively. Now, I'm very curious about that. That's why I wish she was here giving this lecture. That seems odd to me, but we'll get into it a little more when we go into this. Maybe we'll figure it out. Although those differences were so small, they were potentially not clinically significant. Fair statement. Our analysis revealed no significant benefit to performing RAP with limited preoperative fluid administration and minimized CPB circuit prime. We formalized a process that included limiting preoperative fluid administration and minimizing the CPB circuit volume so that we were not required to RAP and did not simultaneously sacrifice patient outcomes in other areas. Okay. And I would say that the only way I would say that different is not required to RAP, but did not simultaneously potentially sacrifice patient outcomes in other areas. I just think that there's a passion about wanting people that believe in RAP. It's almost becoming a religion. And I think that's okay. You know, I really think the risks are very, very low, and the potential benefits are, I think, real. I don't know that I would ever agree with or want to see it classified as a level one recommendation for conducting our bypass, because I do think that there are different ways and in my opinion, better ways to manage this issue, which we're going to get into. RAP in the process a perfusionist uses prior to the initiation of bypass to reduce hemodilution. Okay, so I'm not going to reread this. It's sort of a addition to what we just discussed. So let's look at their data, okay? Patient age, patient size, hemoglobin, crit, creatinine, postoperative history of CKD, preoperative history of end-stage renal disease. So patient age, they're pretty much well-matched. BSA, about the same size. Hemoglobins, preoperatively, about the same, along with crits. Creatinine's pretty much equal. Number of patients that had a history of CKD or end-stage renal disease. Again, very well-matched populations between RAP and no RAP. Here we see their bypass times, their cross-clamp times, their indexed flows. That would be their cardiac index otherwise. Whether they did or didn't use custodial, and that's going to be important to discuss moving on. Microplegia systems, which a lot of people believe in, and I think no doubt reduces the fluid administration, especially with Delnido and custodial similar. Fluid administered by anesthesia, first hemoglobin. Just go down the list here and you can see all of this. But let's focus our attention on the things that were in that discussion. Indexed flow was lower in the RAP group, and that was statistically significant. And the reason for that is volume available in the reservoir. Now, one can argue you need less flow, you have a higher hemoglobin. Lower hemoglobin, you need a higher flow for the same DO2I. And I'm going to show you that. We're going to actually do the numbers and do the math, because ultimately it becomes a math problem. But it was interesting to me that they found this to be the issue. Hemodilution of hemoglobin, it was obviously lower in the non-RAP group than in the Yes. So you lost more hemoglobin. That's what they're saying here. The hemoglobin was lower. And here, that shows it here. But the loss of hemoglobin, the change of pre-op hemoglobin to on bypass, that delta was statistically significantly different in the non-RAP group. So you clearly did have a greater level of hemodilution. There's no question about it. Going down here, urine output was higher in the non-RAP group than in the RAP group, and that was statistically significant, but I have some reservations about thinking that this really has any clinical significance at all. And then postoperative albumin use was also higher, interestingly enough, in the RAP group than in the non-RAP group. Now, that could have just been because they preferred to give albumin 5%, which is more for, you know, volume expansion, rapid volume expansion, and that could have just been some hypotension. But again, it is statistically significant, but I don't believe that it is clinically significant, if I can say that. In this particular study, I'll go ahead and get to their conclusions. In this retrospective study, we examined, that being the authors, the impact of RAP in a heterogeneous population of two consecutive patient groups undergoing CPB. Data analysis showed that the RAP and non-RAP group had equal demographic, preoperative, and CPB characteristics. We looked at their data. Our investigation indicated there was no statistically significant impact of RAP on PRBC transfusion rates, DO2I, incidence of postoperative AKI, intraoperative albumin administrator, ventilator times, ICU length of stay, or 30-day mortality. We did observe a statistically significant increase in albumin infusion in the ICU postoperatively in the RAP group, although the small volume differences were not clinically significant. I completely agree with everything that's being written here. While several published studies show there are potential benefits to RAP, that's true. Our all-inclusive analysis, and when she says all-inclusive, the authors say all-inclusive analysis, they just chose every patient. You either go this arm, you're this time frame, every patient that was done, that time frame, every patient that was done. There's no separating out patients. Found that there was no significant benefit to RAP, wrapping the condensed CPB circuit in our patient population. We suspect that limiting preoperative fluid administration and minimizing our CPB circuit volume eliminated the need for RAP. It makes a tremendous amount of sense. Now, I still think you can do better than this, but we're going to talk about that here moving forward. I did want to bring something up on this particular slide. Fluid administration by anesthesia. It was 1,300 versus 1,350 versus 1,369. Of course, these are basically the same number. In most centers, this is what they give them before they even make it into the operating room. So they really did a lot of fluid restriction, because I joke about it all the time. The anesthesia mantra is, if the pressure is low, give volume. If the pressure is high, give volume. And if the pressure is normal, just give more volume. So it seems anesthesia's solution for everything is to give volume. That is not an uncommon phenomenon. And so they're really, that 1300 cc's is a very, very tight control of fluid administration by anesthesia. And I think that's something that really helps a tremendous amount, because that's something I fight a lot, where a patient is otherwise normal and I go on bypass, correct their COP because I use a lot of albumin. We go on bypass and I've got 4 liters of volume in my oxygenator because the patient just in the operating room has probably gotten already 2,500 cc's of volume. So this is really interesting. And I don't think that's unusual. I think that's fairly common. So what are the variables that, and this study, I also found something interesting too about this study from the Foreman group, was that when they, and let me make sure I say it right, because I started. In the non-RAP group, after they basically took the lines up at the table and cut them, they cut about 3 feet off the AV loop, 1 foot from the arterial and 2 feet from the venous. And if you have a half inch venous line, that can be significant amount of volume. And when you look at the amount, the actual number, it's not necessarily that high. But when you translate that into what I said earlier, every cc in a line, either a return line, arterial line, or an access line or a venous line, every cc in there is not in your reservoir level for your minimum operating level. And so they took about 3 feet off of an already shortened system. The other thing that I thought was very interesting is at the time they stopped RAP, performing RAP, hemoconcentrators were eliminated from the CPB circuit unless custodial was used, and they used the Quest microplegia system, which no question reduces the amount of hemodilution, especially if you use Delnido, right? So the variables that I think are worth discussing are albumin levels and COP. I preach this a lot. We need to be, I think, way more diligent in, I use a lot of albumin, and I want my albumin level to be within normal limits. That's what I want. I don't want it to be low. I don't want it to be high either. I want it to be within normal limits. Your cardioplegia technique, microplege versus Delnido. You're doing Delnido, you're giving 1,200 cc's of crystalloid as a single dose. If you have a small female, that's a lot of volume. So all the wrapping in the world may not be able to help if that's what you're doing. Pre-op condition of the patient, their EF, are they in heart failure? They're going to have fluid. They're going to have excessive total body fluid. Their weights go up. It's not all intravascular. It's in the tissue. So that's a problem. Do they have underlying renal dysfunction? What's their nutrition status? Because that's going to play a big role in their albumin. What meds are they on? Are they on vasodilators? In-house or same-day admits? It's going to make a big difference. How long have they been drying them out? You know, were they on dialysis and they dried them out? That can be a problem too. You come into the OR and you think, oh, great, I got a good crit today. It's 34 for a patient who's in end-stage renal disease, but they're desiccated. So you're going to be giving volume, and the next thing you know, your hematocrit is 18. The anesthesia technique, are they using DEX? That's a big issue, because you really drop your SVR dramatically and vasodilate with that and your fluid needs to keep the tank full to give you a reasonable CVP are going to be much higher. So anesthesia will tend to administer far more volume, both pre-pump and post-pump, in order to keep the your CVP elevated. Are you or are you not using hemoconcentration? I found that very interesting, that the only notation about hemoconcentration was in the final study that I showed you and reviewed, where they just are not using, they didn't use hemoconcentration for when they stopped doing the RAP technique. And I'm assuming that was because they wanted, it was a retrospective study, so I'm not sure why that happened. I can't quite understand it. So I think it's something that I hope, Emily, if you're watching this, you'll want to come and discuss that with us. You also have to think about inflammatory response mitigation, but a big one that is forgotten so often is right here. It's the 800-pound gorilla in the room. How much, so you can do all that anesthesia restriction of fluid, you can cut your lines short, you can do all of those things. How many of us have been on bypass and we see our reservoir volume going up and we look over and we see our pump sucker and it has just Kool-Aid looking fluid pumping through it, and we look up at the table and we see that they've taken the pump sucker and they've dropped it into the left chest where they took the mammary down, and it's sucking out 1500, 1200, 1000 cc's, whatever the case may be, of this ice cold saline that they used as pour cold with some few little cells floating around in it, and it goes into your reservoir. Now what are you going to do with it, because your hematocrit is going down? We got a call. We have a caller. Hello. Hello. You're live on the air. Who's this? Hello.
Hey, Paul. Hey, Paul. It's Dan.
Hey.
With a company called Seamless AI. I was looking at Routeware and was just wondering if you had a quick second.
Who? I'm sorry. Who is this?
Yeah, Paul, it's okay. My name's Dan, and I'm with a company called Seamless AI. So
no, I
looked
think you
up
need to.
LinkedIn.
I'm so sorry. Go ahead and hang up. Please reach out to us a different way, please. Thank you. Go ahead and dump that. That was interesting, though. Seamless AI. Yeah, it would be preferred to not call us live on the air. I guess they just wanted to get a plug in. You know, we got duped, dude. But anyway, I guess it could have been worse, right? So this poor cold irrigation, of course, what's going to happen? You see your blood pressure plummets and, of course, you know, all of the bad things that happen. And I get so frustrated and aggravated when they do that. But it is a wild card to this whole thing, that how do we deal with that? Because that does happen. And I try to, if I notice it, I turn my pump sucker off. Please use the cell saver for that if you don't mind. But now on the other hand, if it's really good thick blood and I really need the volume, you know, I have maybe some misgivings about it being that it's set over there in the pleural space in the chest cavity, and I know I always see hypotension. So there's a reason why I see it. Something doesn't like it in the circulation, but the red blood cells are going to help me a lot, and I need the volume, right? But I think if it's just poor cold and diluted, we probably shouldn't be taking it into the pump. Now, I know there's also oxygenators that you can have a separate cardiotomy section so they can use it, but it doesn't make its way into the main circulation. There's a lot of different techniques that are used to try to defeat that as a problem. But I think we have to all recognize it is a problem. And when that happens, what do you do with that volume? Because it's going to be at the end of the case and you're getting ready to come off bypass, right? So you now have a problem. So that's why I'm going to go over this, and then we're going to look at our app as well in the few minutes I have left. Here's a basic cardiopulmonary bypass circuit, and I'll use this, my highlighter. Here's our venous reservoir. And let's just say, for the sake of argument, that right here would be a volume of 3,000 cc's, okay? And it's giving us the circulating hematocrit of this blood in the entire circuit is 20%, right? Okay. If I take out 1 liter of ultrafiltrate plasma water, I will have reduced the volume in the reservoir, not the total volume from the patient, but in the reservoir, right? Because the patient, to be on cardiopulmonary bypass with flow, has the venous capacitance system is not empty. The heart's empty, CVP is zero, but not the entire body of the venous capacitance system. If it was zero, you would have no flow. You couldn't have flow. So it's a closed system. That capacitance system has still got volume in it, and that's how the whole circuit works. But we're going to reduce the reservoir volume by one third, right? By 33%. 33%. Okay. So I would therefore increase my hematocrit by 33%. But that's really not true because, again, that's not the total blood volume. You'd have to look at the total blood volume to really appreciate that. But I'm just trying to illustrate a point that would raise your hematocrit if I just took 1 liter off by 6%. You would have a hematocrit of 26% versus 20. It's and this is very rudimentary math. I realize that. I'm not trying to insult anybody or bore you guys. But if that were the actual total, but translate that into a total volume. Let's say it's double that. 6 liters is the actual volume. It's still going to raise your hematocrit by removing 1 liter from this reservoir. You could remove 2 liters from that reservoir easily because you don't need an operating level of 1,000 cc's. You need an operating level of about 600 is about where I'm comfortable. And we have, of course, level sensors and things to help protect us. 800 if you're really uncomfortable, but 1,000 cc's certainly. So I could remove 2 liters from this patient's overall circulation and go from a total 6,000 to 4,000. But the patient's probably, let's say, normal size. Maybe they have a total blood volume of 6 liters. There's 3 liters in my oxygenator. So some of that would be in the heart, but that's only going to be a few hundred cc's. So we'll just say it's 6,500 and 6 liters of it's in my reservoir and the lines and all that kind of stuff, everything combined, you know, and 3 liters of it's in the oxygenator. You're going to reduce the total volume down to something that's going to be more like 9 liters, and then you're going to drop it back down to six liters. So you can see easily how these numbers all interact. But at the end of the day, all you have to do is add this hemoconcentrator to the circuit and remove the excess plasma volume, plasma water that is in this reservoir to raise the hematocrit. So if you don't wrap the patient, and you go on bypass and you have 1,400 cc's of volume in your reservoir, and you could have wrapped 600, you would have a level of 800. Well, I can go on bypass and I can just remove that extra 800 with a hemoconcentrator or 600 in almost no time. It'd take me 2 minutes and it's gone. And I didn't have to do all those other maneuvers. Whereas if it's much higher than that, patient's hypervolemic, the wrap worked great, but I can't take any more out if I don't have a hemoconcentrator. And if you have a hemoconcentrator, why bother wrapping them if you can remove it with the hemoconcentrator? Again, my thoughts. Now, use the QR code. I had better see these sales today. You get your QR code, whether you're using Google or whether you're using Apple, and you buy this app, and we're getting ready to do a new update on it. So let me get to my last slide. Let us leave the wrapping to the experts. You've got Jay-Z, you've got Eminem, you've got Snoop D-O-double-G, Tupac and Biggie Smalls and the other ones who I don't know who they are, but please let's leave the wrapping to the wrappers, leave it to the professionals. Okay, now I'm gonna pull up our app and I'm just going to illustrate this. I think it's worth doing. So In this particular case, we come in the morning. We have a patient who is 65 years old. They're a male, which means that the calculation for blood volume would be based on 75 mLs a kilo per kilo versus a woman who would be 65 mLs per kilo. I'm going to give this patient a pre-op hematocrit, which is actually your pre-pump hematocrit, of 36%. We're going to give the patient a height of 178 centimeters. We're going to say that the patient is, I'll make it 85 kilos, not too terribly big. We're going to give it a pump prime, and that's the only thing that I'm going to change, of 1,000 cc's. Okay, I want you to remember that 1,000 cc's. To reduce the variable, I'm going to give anesthesia zero volume, and I'm going to give it zero urine output, just because I want to illustrate a point. That would obviously not be the case, but these are variables that you don't find in any other app. So please, I need you to buy my app. I need to sell a million copies of it, please. And then we're going to calculate it. You even put your heparin dose in, either 300 or 400 mLs per kilogram, whichever you'd prefer. Calculate, and you have a BSA of 2, BMI a little high. Your estimated blood volume is 6375 or 6.4 liters. Red cell volume is 2.3 liters. Heparin dose and your estimated pump on bypass is going to be 31%, and there are all your flows. Now, I want you to remember it was 1,000 cc's, right? And our estimated pump on crit on pump is 31. If I reduce this, because again, it depends. There's such variability with, we wrap just the arterial and venous line. We wrap the oxygenator. We only wrap the venous line. You know, there's a lot of variability in how people perform this procedure, but I'm just going to use it as an example. And I'm going to say you can take out 500 cc's. And I'm going to hit recalculate. So you would raise your hematocrit from 31 to 33. Now that is different. It is higher. That's true. But if I come over here and I say I'm going to pump prime is going to be, instead of 1,000, I'm going to make it 1,400. But I'm going to insert in pre-pump urine, not urine. We're going to relabel that in our mind to ultrafiltration. And I'm going to take out 1,000 cc's of ultrafiltrate. And you see here 33.87, basically no difference. So those are real numbers. Now, again, I think that wrapping seems to be something that people really do believe in, really want to do, really, again, I think it's almost a religion. I don't agree with it. I believe that even though the risk is very, very low, the time it takes to do it, and the any risk for what I consider to be negligible. I believe the risk and time it takes outweighs any benefit if I just have a hemoconcentrator in line where I can control the patient's blood volume by managing plasma water throughout the course of the case. And I'm prepared if I miss them sucking the crystalloid, the pore cold, out of the chest. I can now address that issue. I can come off bypass and realize that the patient was, I'm not going to be able to get all of the pump volume in the patient. So I can concentrate what is in my reservoir and only have the rest of the circuit to be able to flush through, we call it chase. People are familiar with that term. So, you know, I would much prefer that and have a whole blood concentrated whole blood being given back to the patient, then coming off bypass and then throwing that and wasting it to the cell saver, which isn't a total waste because you're giving back the red blood cells, but you're throwing away the plasma and the platelets. That is just a harsh reality. I really liked the Foreman article where they talked about being very disciplined on line length, reducing the overall size and hemodilutional impact of your circuit. I truly believe that using albumin and treating that, looking at the albumin level preoperatively and considering is this patient already hypoalbuminemic, or are they relatively normal, and adjusting the amount of albumin that I give the patient in my prime based on that value, and then taking into consideration everything going on with the case, whether I should give albumin or whether I should give crystalloid, or whether we need to transfuse the patient, because there's some patients that are just going to be transfused and there's nothing we can do about it. But I do agree we should minimize to our best capability the transfusions that we give patients, because transfusions do also carry significant risk. And we want to give as few patients, and of those we have to give it, the fewest number of units to any one patient. It helps with everything, oxygenation, coagulation, all of those various things. Okay, those are all of my comments. If there's any questions, thank you for the good work. Yes, that was, that's on the cup, Medema, and that is David, our director, who is can make these things in his garage. He's really good at it. And Abdullah, it's nice to see you. Good for us here, it's good morning. I know it's evening for you there. I don't see any questions. We're not getting any calls. So our next course coming up is going to be our ECMO course. This is the didactic. It's good for, I believe, how many CEUs is it for perfusion? 18.4 CEU, category one CEU. It's also approved for nursing credits. 19.2, I'm sorry, perfusion credits. And it's also approved for physician CME, and it's approved for nursing credits. So the entire team, that I think that ECMO course is so well done, such great information, incredible speakers, and I think a lot of value. So that's going to be our next course. And then PerfWeb 92 will be sometime in July.
No, we have
okay, so when's our next PerfWeb? Oh, okay. I'll be scheduling. We don't have them scheduled yet. I'll be scheduling PerfWeb 92 probably in August. So you all take care of yourselves, but you will see me, of course, during the ECMO course. I do give some of those lectures and answer some questions. So please do not hesitate to, and I would really suggest you watch that. Because even if you're not going to do ECMO, it will make you a better perfusionist. It will make you a better nurse. It will make you a better physician or nurse practitioner or PA or anything. We have some really incredible content experts that give these lectures. Amit, how are you? What's your opinion in regards to going on pump with the venous line full of crystalloid versus empty with using VAVD? Amit, you are absolutely, I agree with that 100%. I go on with the dry venous line all the time. I don't turn the vacuum up and pop it and let it go woof, where it goes in. I do it gently and fill the line and let it go and reduce the GME, potential GME production that you might have, because that's one of the arguments that I get about using a dry venous line. And I think those people that have done, like, what was his name? Bob Groom? Yeah, the Bob Groom. Yeah, he did a lot of TCD work, and they did show that. So I think you can do it gently. And I do a dry venous line all the time, reduces the amount of volume the patient gets. But I am not like hold fast to that, where as long as I have a hemoconcentrator and I can hemoconcentrate the volume off, why bother? I can just go on with it full and just pop the line open and get on bypass, and let's get this procedure over. Look, remember, the perfusion mantra is out by noon with no balloon, okay? I'm going to have a tee time at 1. So when I say tee, I mean golf, right? Not tee, that kind of tee. I don't do that, but I do golf. And actually, I don't. I can only putt-putt. I can't even golf. But I want to be out of the hospital. So let's get this case going. Let's get it started. Let's get on pump. Let's do the best for the patient, and let's get out of here. Doesn't always work out that way, but that's what I prefer. You're welcome, Amit. All right, you guys be safe. We'll see you next time. I got to go to work and actually do something. Let me get on my mega hat. This is a mega hat. Y'all need one, okay? See you later. Peace out.